It is unconventional, to say the least, to begin a sermon by telling everyone what you're not going to talk about. But I just want to let you know that this Shabbat, unlike last Shabbat and next Shabbat, I'm not talking about Israel. The reason that I'm not on this Shabbat is tonight I'm going to the AIPAC conference. I'll have the chance to hear the President speak and Prime Minister Netanyahu speak and to speak to several other pundits and politicians and so on. And it occurs to me that sometimes it is actually wise to learn something before you talk about it. So rather than say things this week and then come back next week and say, you know what I said last week? Forget it. I'm going to wait, and I'll talk to you about the conference next week. Instead, I actually want to talk about the Parsha. Because in this morning's Parsha, there is a section which many of you may have almost heard, because it is traditionally recited in a whisper. It's called the Tochecha, which means the rebuke. And for many verses in the Tochecha, in Bechukotai, in the section that talks about you must walk in my laws, in my ways, the Tochecha then goes on to say all the terrible things that will happen to you if you don't. And that's why it's recited in a whisper. And the most conventional, not the only, but the most conventional explanation for why bad things happen in the Bible is you don't do what God said. But even though everybody here somewhere in their mind retains that idea that the reason bad things happen is because we didn't do what we were supposed to, everybody here also knows that you can do what you're supposed to and bad things can still happen. And that single explanation is not sufficient. And that no single explanation, and maybe no combination of explanations, is really adequate to explain why bad things happen. But I want to present not an explanation, but an image or a picture or an idea, because it exists powerfully in our tradition, but it is almost the opposite of the way we normally think about ourselves and about the world. And by the way, in some ways, it even explains why I'm not talking about Israel this Shabbat. There are lots of places in the Jewish tradition from which I could draw this image, but let me use the book of Job, since the book of Job in our tradition is the book that protests against what we learned this morning. That is, again and again and again, you hear, do what God says and you'll be fine. Don't do what God says and you'll be in trouble. And along comes the book of Job and presents this almost perfect person who does what God says, and he suffers terribly. He loses his possessions. His children die. His friends argue with him. And then at the end of the book, having suffered, having cried out, God finally appears. And the strange part of the book of Job, or one of the strange parts, since there are many, is that God doesn't say to him, listen, Job, this is why you suffered. In a book that is supposed to explain why it is that we suffer, God never says, this is why you suffer. Instead, what God does at the end of the book is say to Job, you were not there when I created the world. You don't understand the vast natural order. You don't have the strength to draw the Leviathan, the sea monster, out of the sea. You don't know how I strung the stars in the sky. And finally, Job says, "You're right. I'm dust and ashes. I had heard you with my ears, but now I see you with my eyes." And the commentators rush in and say, "What's God trying to say?" And they have 1,000 explanations. Because in this particular instance, God is very obscure. But I want to offer to you the explanation of the Bible scholar, conservative rabbi, noted author Robert Gordas, who wrote a book about Job and tried to figure out what is God saying by telling Job, "You weren't there when I made the world." And this is Dr. Gordas' explanation. He said, what God is saying to Job is you're captured by your ego. You think this is all about you. But there's a vast, interconnected, marvelous, wonder-filled world out there that has nothing, Job, to do with you. And your problem is that because you suffer, it has driven you deeper and deeper and deeper into yourself instead of wider into the world. So all you think about is Job's suffering. And we live, now moving from Dr. Gordas to us, we live in a world that reinforces this all the time. When was the Torah given? The Torah was given to the Israelites in the desert. And the desert, with its implacable indifference to any individual human being, reminded the Israelites, you're puny in God's world. You're nothing. At night in the desert, you look up at the sky and you see this vast array of stars, and you realize we're less than a speck. But we don't live in the desert. You know where we live? We live in the city. And you know what you see in the city? You see the products of human beings. The city makes us important. When you walk out of this building, what do you see? You see buildings. You see roads. You see cars. Who made them? We did. You look up at the sky and you see a little narrow slice of sky, but you're not overwhelmed by the magnificence of nature. You don't say, oh my God, I'm really very small. No, in the city, it's all about us. We don't build cities for mountains, we build cities for people. And therefore, because we have this culture of individualism, of self-realization, of the city, of achievement, of success, when we suffer, we don't take a larger view. The Dutch author Harry Mulisch, who died this past year, who wrote a wonderful, rich, philosophical book called The Discovery of Heaven, someone asked him the secret of life, and he said, the secret of life is to make the puzzle bigger. That when something happens to you, take a more expansive view, not a small view. And the larger you expand, the more you realize that actually in the vastness of the puzzle, you count less, not more. And most of the time, our emphasis is the opposite. Because we don't live in the natural world. We aren't captured by what's not us. You read the English romantic poets, like Tintern Abbey, Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey, and you hear how the sounding cataract haunts him, and how nature never did betray the heart that loved her, and you realize they live in a wider world than we do. Even though we have the internet, we have cell phones. That was planned. That was all planned. I said, at 11:18, 23 actually, we're connected to the wider world, but we don't live in the wider world. We live in the world that reinforces our presuppositions, our importance. We put people up on billboards, and we go to see them in movie theaters, and we celebrate the human, and we forget. That when the psalmist writes, 1,000 years is but a day in your sight, that in 1,000 years, everything we know will be gone from this earth. When I said that in some ways this explains why I'm not talking about Israel, it's because it's very easy to get captured by our interests and our passions and our concerns, and there's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes you got to step back and realize that actually the entire world is not only about the Jews. That not every country spends all day and all night thinking about Israel. That for some people, Jerusalem is not the zenith of human striving and hopes. That there are, for example, a lot of Chinese. And they think about other things than what is Netanyahu going to say when he addresses AIPAC. And so while it is not wrong and not misguided to care about what you care about, it is always wrong and always misguided to care about only what you care about. And to not see that our sufferings and our dreams, they are a tiny slice of this great pageant and huge drama. That there are universes out there. That the past stretches very far and the future perhaps even farther. When I have fears, wrote Keats in one of his most famous poems, when I have fears that I may cease to be, before my pen has gleaned my teeming brain, when he's afraid that he's going to die before he gets to write everything down, Keats, who, by the way, died at age 24. So he was right. Then he looks up at the sky and he thinks how he'll never see this and he'll never experience that. And he ends up then on the shore of the wide world. I stand and think, I stand alone and think, till love and fame to nothingness do sink. Everything disappears when you stand on the shore of the wide world and you see that what God is showing to Job is true. That if we draw the camera back and get a wider and wider and wider view of who we are, of what this is, then you know that from the space shuttle you can't see your house. You see a globe, and if you pull it further back, you see a galaxy. And we, with all of our concerns, and all of our passions, and all of our ego, and all of our certainty, and all of our self-importance, we disappear. That, too, is a genuine religious vision. Remember that the Hasidic rabbi suggested a couple hundred years ago that you carry two pieces of paper in your pocket, one saying, Bishvili nivra ha'olam, for me the world was created. And when you think you don't matter and God can't care about you, then you take that out. But the other one, the other pocket says, Ani afar ve'efer, I am dust and ashes. Because that's what we came from, and to dust and ashes will we return. It is not a counsel against caring, but it is worth keeping a tiny part of our hearts aware of the fact that everything we care about will disappear. And that the essence of King Solomon's wisdom was engraved on the ring that he wore. Gamza Yavor, this too will pass. It's not only true of situations, it's true of people. So every now and then, it is good to let go of the fierceness of your concern and to step back and to realize how many other dramas have been, are, and will be, and to take a breath and to let go, because ultimately, it's not in our hands anyway. It's in God's. Shabbat Shalom.